Please repeat. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We shall read a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, which is quoted in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. It appears in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, Chapter 1, as text 59. Tato dusangam usriya satsu sajeta buddhiman. Santa evasya chindanti manavya sangam uktibi. Tato dusangam utsriya satsu sajeta buddhiman. Santa evasya chindanti manavya sangam uktibi. Please repeat. Tata, therefore, dusangam, bad association, utsrijya, giving up, satsu, with the devotees. Sajeta, one should associate. Buddhiman, an intelligent person. Santa, devotees. Eva, certainly. Asya, ones, chindanti, cut off, manahavya sangam, opposing attachments, uktibhi, by their instructions. Translation. One should therefore avoid bad company and associate only with devotees. With their realized instructions, such saints can cut the knot connecting one with activities unfavorable to devotional service. Please repeat. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This verse, which appears in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.26.26, was spoken by Lord Krishna to Uddhava in the text known as the Uddhava Gita. The discussion relates to the story of Pururava and the heavenly courtesan Urvasi. When Urvasi left Pururava He was deeply affected by the separation and had to learn to overcome his grief. It is indicated that to learn the transcendental science, it is imperative that one avoid the company of undesirable persons and always seek the company of saints and sages who are able to impart lessons of transcendental knowledge. The potent words of such realized souls penetrate the heart, thereby eradicating all misgivings accumulated by years of undesirable association. For a neophyte devotee, there are two kinds of persons whose association is undesirable. One, gross materialists who constantly engage in sense gratification. And two, unbelievers who do not serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but serve their senses and their mental whims in terms of their speculative habits. Intelligent persons seeking transcendental realization should very scrupulously avoid their company. Then the next text, 60, is another verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Satam prasangan mama virya samvido bhavanti ritkarna rasayana katha tajoshanad aspapavarga vartmani shradha ratir bhaktir anukramishyati. Satam prasangan mama virya samvido bhavanti ritkarna rasayana katha tajoshanadasvapavargavartmani shradha ratir bhaktir anukramishyati. Please repeat. Satam of the devotees. Prasangat, by intimate association. Mama, of me. Virya samvida, talks full of spiritual potency. Bhavanti, appear. Hrit, to the heart. Karna, and to the ears. Rasayana, a source of sweetness. Katha, talks. Tat, of them. Joshanat, from proper cultivation. Ashu, quickly. Apavarga, of liberation. Vartmani, on the path. Shraddha, faith. Rati, attraction. Bhakti, love. Anukramishyati, will follow one after the other. Translation. The spiritually powerful message of Godhead can be properly discussed only in a society of devotees, and it is greatly pleasing to hear in that association. If one hears from devotees, The way of transcendental experience quickly opens to him, and gradually he attains a taste in knowledge that in due course develops into attraction and devotion. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This verse appears in Srimad Bhagavatam 3:25-25, where Kapila Dev replies to the questions of his mother Devahuti about the process of devotional service. As one advances in devotional service, the process becomes progressively clearer and more encouraging. Unless one gets this spiritual encouragement by following the instructions of the spiritual master, it is not possible to make advancement. Therefore, one's development of a taste for executing these instructions is the test of one's devotional service. Initially, one must develop confidence by hearing the science of devotion from a qualified spiritual master. Then, as he associates with devotees and tries to adopt the means instructed by the spiritual master in his own life, his misgivings and other obstacles are vanquished by his execution of devotional service. Strong attachment for the devotional service of the Lord develops as he continues listening to the messages of Godhead. And if he steadfastly proceeds in this way, he is certainly elevated to spontaneous love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these two verses describe the necessity of associating with a bona fide spiritual master, with devotees. And it is a process that repeats itself day after day, year after year, generation after generation, millennium after millennium. It is something that all of us have experienced in our lives, those of us who are on the path of progressive development of Krishna consciousness. In my own case, my first association with any devotee really came when I met Srila Prabhupada as a child. Around the age of 8, or at most 10, I was walking home from school, and I came to an intersection. There was quite a big road that I had to cross on the walk back home. And while stopping at the road, waiting for a break in the traffic, I looked across the road into the distance, and there were many trees. There was a park and many trees. I lived in a suburb of Chicago, and I somehow got some sort of inkling or intuition that, what's the talking behind the curtains? Can we I got sort of some sort of inkling or intuition that people are suffering, and that in the future I will have a mission to relieve them of their suffering. And I was, as I mentioned, only 8 or 10 years old. I certainly remembered the experience, but I had no idea of what it meant. Then, as I matured and entered high school, I had the idea to attain perfection. At the time, I read a book by Eric Fromm called The Art of Loving. And from the book, I got the idea that perfection meant to be able to love. He explained that love is not a feeling, but it is a process or an activity. So I developed the idea that love was the solution to all problems. And so I entered the university, and in the university, somehow many of my friends were older than I was. One of them was named Randy Meyer, and he was older. And I guess I was quite naive. I maybe led somewhat of a sheltered life. And, you know, I would see that sometimes he would just go into his room and lie down and not want to get up. And, you know, I would go into his room, and with the idea that love, you know, could cure all ills and solve all problems, I would spend time with him, hoping that my love would release him from his misery. But I found that there was something in him that did not allow him to receive my love, or maybe even perceive it. And then I thought, I have to go deeper. It's not so simple that just by giving someone love you can cure all their ills and solve all their problems. So I became a major in the Department of Psychology. And the Department of Psychology at Brandeis University was very progressive. The chairman of the department was Abraham Maslow, and he was developing what he called a third force in psychology. Up until then, there were two major forces or schools of thought. One was behaviorism, which basically studied the human organism as if it were an animal, stimulus and response. And, you know, one of the first in that field was Pavlov. He was a Russian psychologist who did experiments with dogs, and then later in America the main authority was B.F. Skinner, who did experiments with rats. And the other major school was psychoanalysis, founded by Sigmund Freud, which studied basically people's psychological weaknesses or abnormalities. So Abraham Maslow said, you know, we're not going to study rats, and we're not going to study unhealthy people, but we will study healthy people and find out what is common to them and develop a theory or a science of what he called self-actualization, in which the individual would realize his full potential. He said that there is a hierarchy of needs, that on a basic level we need, you know, food, shelter, clothing. And then after that level of need, there are social needs to be accepted and loved and whatever. And in this hierarchy of needs, the highest was the need for self-actualization, to realize one's full potential as a living being. And he found that quite common to self-actualized persons were peak experiences. And in these peak experiences, they felt some sort of unity or harmony within the universe and between themselves and the universe, or creation, or all that exists. So, I was intrigued, and none of the other departments really spoke anything to me in any case, so I entered that department. And at the same time, I was reading books on Eastern spirituality, and, you know, wanted to attain perfection in that way. Anyway, one day, Professor Maslow told a story that he woke up and he was trembling. He was experiencing various symptoms, and he wasn't sure what they were. So he phoned a colleague of his, who was also a psychologist, and asked, you know, told him what his symptoms were and asked him, what is it? And his colleague said that you are suffering an anxiety attack. And Professor Maslow told us that he had written chapters in books on anxiety attacks. But when he himself had one, he couldn't recognize it. So then I understood there's a difference between theoretical knowledge and practical realization. Another thing I found in the department, although they discussed very lofty ideas, was that within the department there was a lot of bickering over position and appointments. You know, although the predominating force in the department was third force, but the behaviorists, you know, they still wanted professors appointed in their school, and the psychoanalysts wanted professors appointed in their school, and there's competition over appointments, over promotions, over the distribution of the budget. And I thought, you know, these people discuss very high ideas, but when it comes down to it, they act just like ordinary people. So I thought maybe, you know, psychology isn't the way. So I continued reading books covering a wide range of Eastern philosophies and practices. And finally I came to the conclusion that I need a guru, that I cannot achieve self-realization, you know, just by reading books or performing practices on my own. So then my mission became how to find my guru. And Brandeis, given the nature of the Department of Psychology especially, invited many swamis and yogis and teachers. How much time do we have? When does anyone know what the schedule is?
Some of our prayers are at 8.
Phew. I mean, I could abridge this story, but so much would be lost. The other way is I just go as far as I can and then continue next time. I don't even... Well, we'll see how... Yeah, we'll do that. So one of the guest speakers was a famous Hatha yogi from India who had an ashram in New York. And he gave a lecture, and he said that by practice of yoga, one could master control over one's involuntary muscles. And one could actually command his intestines. And he said, you know, you can command your I forget the names, but ascending colon advance, and then it would move the stuff along. Transverse column advance, then it would move it further. And then descending colon advance, and it would move it down, and then rectum release. So I thought, well, is this really the goal of yoga? Is this going to help me attain the perfection of life? But still, I kept an open mind. And I thought, all right, let me, you know, maybe he's just mentioning one of the lower level benefits, but maybe there's more to it. So, you know, I told the organizers of the lecture that that I would like to speak to the Swamiji. So he said, you know, the Swamiji is going directly to the airport after the lecture. So I said, well, can I ride in the car with him? He said, no, but you could probably get a lift with some of the other disciples and come to the airport with them. I said, all right. So I got in the car with the other disciples, and the main topic that they were discussing in the car was the food they missed since moving into the ashram. Primarily pizza. And I was also attached to pizza, so I was listening. But I thought, you know, this isn't very impressive. You know, they've come to live in the ashram, to practice yoga, to learn from the master, and all they're talking about is the different types of food they miss. But still, I kept an open mind. I thought, anyway, they're just the students. We can't really judge completely from the students. Let me meet the master. So we arrived at the airport, and there was the master with his long flowing orange robes and long beard and hair and smiling very beatifically with a twinkle in his eyes. He was really the picture of, you know, Indian spirituality. And one of his young lady disciples, you know, he's just getting ready to leave. She came up to him and they embraced very warmly and tightly. And then I thought, you know, this is not my perfect master. Then there was another, more of a philosopher from India. And he gave a full-day seminar, a morning session and an afternoon session. And the hall was packed. I could hardly get in. I mean, he was in a smaller hall. The other yogi was in the auditorium. So, okay, during the lunch break, I approached my professor. He was the main one who was organizing the speakers. And I told him, you know, I want to meet the speaker. He said, why do you want to meet him? I said, well, I'm looking for a guru and I want to see if maybe he's my guru. He said, oh, he doesn't accept disciples. He doesn't even touch money. So I thought, you know, if he has knowledge that can help people, why for the sake of some artificial renunciation or show of detachment should he refuse? So I thought, he's not my perfect master. Then I heard about a Zen master who had an ashram in upstate New York. I had actually read his book, and he had studied Zen from a Zen master in Japan who was supposedly certified as enlightened. And the enlightened Zen master in Japan had certified the Zen master in New York as being enlightened. And one weekend he was having like an introductory weekend, you know, I guess from Friday evening till Sunday afternoon. So I thought, let me investigate. So I went to the ashram, and one of the students opened the door, and I walked in. I saw some of the other students, and they didn't seem very lively or happy. But again, I thought, well, they're just the students. We can't judge completely just from the students. So then, the course began. We were told how to sit cross-legged with our backs erect. And each of us had, we sat around the room facing the wall. And we were told to, sit cross-legged with our backs erect and to meditate on some riddle, koan. Like one famous one is, you've heard the sound of two hands clapping. Or what is the sound of one hand clapping? Now, so the idea of the riddles is that you cannot get the answer with your logical mind, and eventually you have to give up the use of your logical mind and go beyond it. I mean, there is a logic to it, but the mind is the source of bondage, and you have to go beyond the mind. And if the Zen master detected that you were slumping or you were distracted, that your mind was wandering, he would walk around the room with a stick, and then he would hit you on the shoulder with his stick. So the exercise was pretty austere. And the threat of the Zen master coming and hitting you on the shoulder with the stick was fearsome. But I endured it because I wanted to reach my goal. I wanted to become, find perfection. I wanted to find perfection. So during the lunch break, everyone went to the dining hall. They had wood benches and tables and served a probably macrobiotic diet. And so I sat at the table with the master. I wanted to find out about the master. So he told one of the students, I didn't hear what the student said, I could only imagine, but the master said, yes, you're right, I shouldn't have lost my temper. So I thought, he lost his temper. But then I'd read in the books that Zen masters appear ordinary. So I thought, well, maybe this is just part of it. He appears ordinary, but maybe he's extraordinary. So I finished the weekend and returned to the university. I wasn't very impressed, but I hadn't eliminated him the way I eliminated the others. And then within 2 weeks, the same Zen master was invited to speak at MIT, also in the Boston area. And I went. And he gave his presentation. And at the end, one lady raised her hand and asked about Vedanta. And the Zen master replied, I have enough trouble keeping up with Zen. Don't ask me about Vedanta. So then I thought, he's not my perfect master. Now, I was becoming hopeless. I mean, there were others. You know, there were others. And I was despairing, you know, how am I ever going to meet my perfect master? I met so many others as well. And finally, one day, I saw on the university campus an advertisement. Lecture, Bhagavad Gita as it is, Swami Bhaktivedanta, you know, Schwartz Auditorium, such and such time. So by then I was so discouraged from all the swamis and yogis that I'd met, I was losing hope. But I took note of it, but I was already losing hope. So the night of the lecture, I had a program to see a movie at Harvard Square in Cambridge, also near in the Boston area. I was already a vegetarian, so I invited a few friends over, and we had spaghetti and some vegetables and soup and bread. And then, you know, at the end of the dinner, we were all going to see the film, an art film. But I was remembering that poster that I'd seen on campus. So everything was moving along towards getting in the car and going to the movie. And I said, you know, there's a lecture on campus tonight on the Bhagavad Gita by a swami, and you know, maybe we should go to the lecture. So my friends did not like this idea, especially one lady friend. She became very upset. And she said, you know, why can't you be like other people? Why do you always have to be running after these swamis and yogis? And I was the type who didn't like to displease people, especially her and my other close friends, male friends. So I tried to go along with what they wanted, but something inside of me kept pushing me that, you know, you must go. So I kept trying to agree, but I couldn't. This force within me just kept pushing me. And they were adamant, especially the one young lady. So, but I was desperate. I could not overrule this force within my heart that was impelling me to go to the lecture. So finally, as a compromise, I said, okay, this will be the last swami I ever go to. All right, that was it. We got in the car, drove to the university, entered the auditorium, and there was Srila Prabhupada on the stage, and he was surrounded by disciples. And later I learned Satsvarupa, he was leading the kirtan. Because of the whole argument at the apartment, we only reached in time for the last kirtan. So Satsvarupa was leading the kirtan, and the auditorium, it was quite modern, quite tasteful in its own way. It had bare brick walls. And the sound of the kirtan was just reverberating throughout the hall. And students were getting up from their seats and jumping up on the stage and joining the kirtan and dancing with the devotees around Srila Prabhupada. And I was also really affected by the kirtan. And I also felt like getting up and jumping on the stage and joining the chanting and dancing. But I looked, you know, at my friends and thought, oh boy, this will definitely be too much for them. So I just stood up. In my place, I stood up and I was sort of swaying back and forth and singing and clapping. Then at the end of the kirtan, one of the devotees announced that because they didn't have, the temple didn't own any motor vehicles then. I don't know what they arranged for Srila Prabhupada, but and one of the devotees announced that if anyone has a car and is driving either to Boston or Cambridge, please meet us in the lobby of the auditorium because we need a lift. So we were going to Harvard Square, and I had a red Rambler station wagon. Do they even use the term station wagon now? Yeah, it could hold a lot of people. So I went to the lobby, and the first devotee I met was Bharadraj. And he was like intoxicated with Krishna. And he just blurted out that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna showed his universal form to Arjuna. And his universal form was more brilliant than hundreds and thousands of suns. And when Arjuna saw the universal form, his knees were quaking, and he said, "Please, Krishna, I cannot bear to see this form. Please show me your original form." And he just described the whole thing. It was like, wow, I thought this person's really high up there. So then I said, you know, I heard the announcement and we're going to Harvard Square. I have a station wagon. I can take some of the devotees. Okay. So they all piled in. I don't know how they fit. But I was driving, and then there was the lady, young lady, and then another, a lady devotee named Janava. She was in the front seat. And then there was another lady devotee, Saradia, and a number of men, and they just squeezed in the back seat and then the back compartment. And Satsarupa squeezed in the back compartment with my best friend, who was named Gary. And so I was hearing Satsarupa and Gary arguing, you know. And Gary was saying, you know, ultimately everything is void. And Satsarupa was saying, there is no void in the creation of God. And I was sitting in the front hearing it, and I thought I was like really smart. So I'd read, I turned around and told them something I'd read in a Zen book, which I thought would solve the whole problem. So I said, it's not void, and it's not void. But to give it a name, we call it the void. Well, that brilliant, profound statement had absolutely no effect. And they continued their argument. I could hear it going on. I thought, all right, let them argue, you know, what can I do? So then I spoke to Janava, and I asked her all these questions that were on my mind. So I said, what about Zen? So she said that it's as if you're watching a movie on a screen, and you see all these images, and it looks real, but actually it's not real. They're just images on a screen. And if you withdraw your consciousness from the screen, you'll find there's a beam of light. And if you follow the beam of light back, it comes to a point. You're saying, like, that's the void. But behind that point is a projector. And behind the projector is a person who's operating the machine. And I thought, wow. This was the best explanation of Zen that I'd ever heard from anyone. And it went further than Zen, you know, to something I'd never even imagined. So I was very impressed. So then I asked, well, what about Yogananda? Because I'd read the book Autobiography of a Yoga. I said, what about Yogananda? He said, oh, he's just a shopkeeper. You go to his ashram and he just keeps in stock whatever you might want. You know, you want Shiva, he's got Shiva in stock. You want Durga, he's got Durga in stock. You want, meditation, he's got meditation in stock. You want sacrifices, he's got sacrifice. Whatever you want, he keeps it in stock. Wow. And then she said, at his ashram, he has a monument to Mahatma Gandhi. And he calls Mahatma Gandhi a worker for world peace. Mahatma Gandhi was not a worker for world peace. He was working for India's political independence. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi was. Wow. This woman, so powerful. I mean, I've never heard anyone talk like this with so much conviction and authority and truth. But she was just a young girl, you know, 20 years old or 22 years old. I knew that this authority couldn't just be coming from her, that she had to be getting her authority from someone else. And I presumed it was from her guru. So I was really eager now to meet the guru. So like this we were discussing. And finally we got to Harvard Square, where I was to leave them off, and then I was going to go to the art film. So I let them out, and I realized, oh my God, I don't know how to contact them. I don't have their address or their phone number or anything. So I parked the car at Cambridge Circle and ran after them. And the first devotee I caught, he moved a little more slowly, and he spoke slowly. I also do that. And his name was Petit Pava. So I caught up to him, and he looked at me, and he said, you see all these people, the people at Harvard Square? They're just like sleepwalkers. They don't know who they are or where they're going. They're just like sleepwalkers. Oh, wow. These people are on such a high level. I thought, I really, really want to meet the guru. So, but he was speaking, you know, in such an intriguing way. I was just listening to what he was saying. And then suddenly my concentration on his words were interrupted by the sound of honking horns. And I realized, oh my God. I parked my car on the side of Cambridge Circle, and I'm causing a traffic jam. And all the cars are honking their horns, wanting someone to move that vehicle that was parked. I said, okay, quickly, give me the address. You know, give me the phone number, give me the address. So I went the next night. And the little temple room, 95 Glenville Avenue in Alston, Massachusetts, it was packed. But I managed to get in the room, and Srila Prabhupada was speaking, but he was actually introducing another speaker. He said, "We are very fortunate to have with us a devotee from Montreal, and now we will ask him to speak a few words." And then Prabhupada's disciple Hansaduta spoke. He spoke nicely. And then Prabhupada spoke. And because he had quite a thick Bengali accent then, and I was not familiar with the subject at all, I couldn't really understand that much of what he said. But at a certain stage, he quoted a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, and he said, "Out of many thousands of men, hardly one will seek perfection." And I thought, that's me. He's talking about me. So I was very interested in what he had to say, and at the end of the talk he asked for questions, so I raised my hand and I asked the question that was burning within my heart. And I said, "There's so many yogis and masters, and each one advocates a different process of self-realization. And each one says that his method is best. So how do I know which is actually best?" And he replied very intelligently. He asked, "What is your goal?" Because I'm asking what is the best means. But then the question is, what is your goal? Because you'll adopt the means that is suitable to the goal. Then he said, "Do you want to serve God or do you want to become God?" He said, "If you want to become God, that means that you're not God now. And how can not God become God?" He said, "God is always God. He doesn't have to become God by practicing yoga or meditation." And then he said, "Krishna is God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of Yashoda. He's God when he's speaking on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He's God when he's in Dwarka. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, that God is within you. He's in your heart. And you can become godly, but you cannot become God. Then he said, if you want to serve God, and you sow the seed of service to God, God will provide the sunlight and fresh air and everything necessary to make. And if you water the seed with chanting, then God will provide the sunlight and fresh air and everything else you need to make the plant grow. But if you want to become God, why should God help the competition? Then he said, God is in your heart. He's ready to help you. But if you don't want to serve him, you're only cheating yourself. So, at this stage, I got the distinct impression that Srila Prabhupada knew everything about me. That he was seeing right through me, through the walls of the temple, out onto the streets, down the roads, right to my apartment. That he was seeing into my apartment, into my bathroom, onto the wall where I had pinned up a sign that I had written in very ornate letterings with different color, a sign that read, that said, "You are God." Just to remind myself in case I forgot. And I felt, you know, Srila Prabhupada's talking to me and he is seeing that sign in my bathroom. And at the end of his presentation, he asked me, "So, what do you think? You want to serve God or you want to become God?" So by then, I knew that I should say that I want to serve God, and I knew that's what I had to do. So I began to say, "I want to serve God." But I knew he knew everything, that I couldn't cheat him. So I began, "I want to serve God," but I realized actually I wanted to become God. He said, "Yes." Then I knew I had found my perfect master for whom I had been searching. And then I offered my obeisances and surrender. I knew I found my perfect master and I had to surrender to him. And I wanted to surrender to him. So I kept my head down on the floor for quite a while. At the time, I mean, you know, I thought I was showing my surrender, but there was also another element, which is that I felt that I had been exposed in front of the whole temple for my abominable desire to become God. And I was afraid to lift my head up, because I imagined that everyone would just be looking at me and glaring at me like, "Oh, he wanted to be God. He wanted to become God." So part of it was I just didn't want to have to face the humiliation of facing the people in the temple. But then I heard sounds that indicated that food was being served. And I heard other sounds that indicated that the people who were eating the food were really relishing it. So I thought, okay, well, they're distracted now. It's probably safe to come up. So I came up and I saw, you know, instead of seeing all these people looking at me and grimacing and staring at me, when I got up, I saw some people did look towards me, but they were smiling and beaming, happy. So I felt relieved. Oh, this is nice. This is nice. And then there was this big plate of prasad in front of me. So it looked very exotic. It was very colorful. I mean, there was rice, which was white, and then there was, I think, daivada, which they made it, it looked a little yellow. And then there was chutney, that looked, you know, and the pakoras, I mean, just so many different colors. I'd never seen them, such a plate. So I took one piece of something and put it in my mouth, and you know, my teeth bit through it, and there was this explosion of tastes. You know, it was like there was like a hard outer shell, and I bit through the outer shell, and there was a soft inside. It was later I figured it was a pakora. And wow, you know, I've never tasted anything like this. And then I went around the plate tasting the different items, and each one was extraordinary. And I thought, wow, everything about this is wonderful. This is like perfect. So anyway, many things happened in that week when Srila Prabhupada was there. But again, because we have some time restraints. So finally, after a week or so, all the devotees were in a sort of excited mood. So I asked, what's happening? And the devotees said, Srila Prabhupada is leaving and we're getting ready to take him to the airport. So I thought, Prabhupada is leaving. I didn't know that he would ever go anywhere, because from the moment I met the devotees in Boston, he was there. I just assumed he would always be there. So yeah, I was a little concerned. So they said, would you like to come? I said, yes, I'd like to come. So we all drove to the airport. I mean, I had my vehicle, and they had another vehicle for Srila Prabhupada. And at the airport, I saw all the devotees were crying. So I asked one devotee, Arundhati, why are all the devotees crying? And she said that Srila Prabhupada said on the absolute platform, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of ecstasy. So the answer struck me. It sounded like a perfect answer. But still, there was some doubt whether it's really practical. And then Prabhupada boarded the aircraft, and the devotees were waiting in the departure lounge. And they were not leaving. So again, I asked, you know, what's happening? And Arundhati replied that Srila Prabhupada said that when the spiritual master leaves, you should watch the plane until it completely disappears in the sky, just like the gopis watched Krishna's chariot when it left Vrindavan until it disappeared in the distance. So we waited and the plane disappeared and we left. But still that doubt remained. I thought, everything about Krishna consciousness is perfect. You know, the philosophy, the process, I had wonderful experiences chanting, which I haven't had time to share with you tonight. The prasad and the devotees, and everything seemed perfect. But I thought maybe this is the one defect that the spiritual master leaves. So that doubt remained, and then one day at Copley Square, we were chanting in front of the subway station, and suddenly I felt Srila Prabhupada's presence descend on me. It was so tangible. I just knew he was there. And I felt some feeling, some sort of ecstasy. And then I thought about Srila Prabhupada's statement that Arundhati had quoted, that on the absolute platform there's no difference between meeting and separation. Both are occasions of ecstasy. And I thought, yes, it is true. It is true. And I concluded, yes, everything about Krishna consciousness is perfect. And now, and then in the years to come, my main, you could say, joy in life was bringing people to meet Srila Prabhupada. And then after he left physically in 1977, I was also thinking, well, now what will I do? But based on that early experience, and of course so many other experiences since then, I feel I can still introduce people to Srila Prabhupada, that they can still experience his presence, still experience his love, his compassion, his mercy. And that by reading his books and following his instructions and chanting the holy names and associating with devotees, people can come in touch with him and get the benefit of the philosophy and process that he came to give us. So this is the beginning of what I read in the beginning. This is the beginning of associating with the devotee. The powerful messages of Godhead that came from him entered my heart and changed me. From that association, I took up the practice of Krishna consciousness, and as described in the second verse from the third canto, one feels progressive encouragement as one follows the instructions of the spiritual master and one makes advancement. And at the same time, one loses the taste for material association and material topics. It doesn't mean that when we go to work we can't have normal interaction with ordinary people at work, or if we have family members who are not on the path of devotional service, it doesn't mean we can't have, you know, normal interactions with them. But it means that we should not associate with them intimately. We shouldn't take their advice on spiritual matters, because they will always give that same type of advice. Why can't you be like other people? Why do you have, you know, that's the advice they'll give. So, yeah, we can have normal, sort of polite interactions with them, but not intimate association. Intimate association we should have with devotees, and that will move us along this wonderful path of Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna. So, I don't know what I could ask for questions, but I say I'm constrained by time, but actually I'm not. It's a special occasion. You're all, you know, you're all very advanced. I mean, outside of Kartik maybe, but during Kartik, Damodar, he couldn't be bound by his mother's rope, so it's part of Damodar. He just all right, well, we'll yes, in Janutta Prabhu.
Yeah, I had a question that sort of confused me. I know that it's considered good to discuss about Krishna with other people, spread Krishna consciousness. One way is like through book distribution, giving your friends a copy of the Gita and so forth. There was one thing that I just read a few minutes ago in the gift shop. I think I've read this before. It says, like, basically, if you hear about spiritual topics from non-Vaishnava devotees, it's like drinking milk from a snake or something like that. So I guess what I'm saying is, since I don't have a spiritual master, and, you know, therefore I'm not a Vaishnava devotee, I'm just an ordinary person who's interested in Krishna consciousness, but isn't spiritually advanced, so to speak. So when friends ask me questions about Krishna consciousness and stuff like that, and, you know, usually I told them things such as, there are three modes of nature: goodness, passion, ignorance, and basically, you know, told them that there are 8,400,000 species of life, and depending on, and basically that our happiness and sadness are based on what we've done, possibly in the past, in this life, or previous life, and so forth. So if I say all these things, since I'm not you know, a Vaishnava devotee, is my words poison, or should I just tell them to go to the temple and have your questions answered? And
That is a good question. That verse, a Vaishnava mukodgirnam harikatamrita. Yes, that milk is very nourishing. But if milk is touched by the lips of a serpent, it causes poisonous effects. That refers especially, it refers to hearing from non-devotees, especially Mayavadis. Although you're not an advanced devotee, let us say, but there are different stages in devotional service. Ado Shraddha, first is faith, Tata Sadhu Sangha, then associating with devotees, and Bhajana Kriya. Now, the stage of Bhajana Kriya includes initiation. But there are still stages before initiation. So if you have some faith and attraction for the messages of Krishna and you are associating regularly with devotees, you are in one of the preliminary stages of devotional service. And Srila Prabhupada says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that even a neophyte, if he has faith that the holy name of Krishna is not different from Krishna, he can awaken faith in others. So you can and should. That said, if someone asks a question to which you don't know the answer, you should not speculate. At that point, you should say, well, you know, I'm just beginning, and I have faith in this philosophy and this process, but, I can't answer that particular question. So you could say either, you know, give me some time, and I'll come back to you with the answer, or, you know, either that or invite them to the temple to a program where they can meet a more experienced devotee. And as far as distributing books, they're getting Prabhupada directly, so there's no problem distributing books. And even the holy name, once someone asks Srila Prabhupada that question, that the chanting should be heard from the lips of a pure devotee. So what if someone hears the chanting from us? And Srila Prabhupada replied, you know, well, you know, my students have heard the holy name from me, and you're hearing the holy name from my students, and you're repeating the holy name that you've heard from them, so it's the same as them having heard it from me. So as long as you're in the parampara and don't speculate and, or, you know, add anything or subtract anything, you can present the message as it is. You can give people the holy name. You can certainly give them the books and invite them to the temple or other programs. Indranuja Prabhu?
Immediately take the sign off from your bathroom.
I don't specifically remember, but I don't even know if I would have wanted to look at it again. I might have just thrown paint on it. I did remove it. I got books from the temple. I got pictures, and I changed my apartment, and then eventually, you know, fairly soon after that, I moved into the temple. Yes, sir.
Do you still feel Srila Prabhupada's presence in the same way that you felt that time in Boston after his physical disappearance?
Yes, I do. It's not the same all the time. You know, it's sometimes I feel his separation. You know, there are different dynamics in spiritual emotion, but the experience I had of feeling his presence outside, you know, the Copley Square subway station is not limited to when he was physically present. I mean, I've had similar experiences even after his physical departure. In fact, I had a very vivid one just a little after his departure. We took a small deity of Srila Prabhupada on parikrama, pilgrimage to Govardhan Hill. It was his desire to go to Govardhan Hill just before he left his body. So he took his deity to Govardhan Hill. And on the parikrama, we ended up at Radhakund and Shyamakund. And there's a median between the two called the Sangama. And we brought the palanquin with the small deity onto the Sangama. Devotees were doing kirtan. And suddenly that deity, I don't know, I just felt that deity is Srila Prabhupada. There's absolutely no difference between that deity and Srila Prabhupada. And that was, you know, within a few days after he left. And there have been other experiences over the years. And there have been experiences where I felt the same way engaging in service as I did when he was physically present. So it's not limited to the time he was physically present. No, not at all. Where do I go for guidance when I'm troubled? His Holiness Ratutvaja Swami. I go to my God brothers. I take shelter of the holy name and chant the holy name. I come in front of the deities and pray to the deities. I read the books. And I get answers from all of them, from the books, from the deities, from the holy name, from God brothers and other devotees. Or sometimes, yeah, I just go to sleep and I wake up and I get the answer. I take a shower and I get the answer. Because Krishna's in our heart. He's always with us. And if we're sincere to serve him, he gives us the intelligence how to serve him. And he answers our questions. It doesn't always come immediately, but it will eventually come. But I think in your case, probably be good to speak to a devotee or to chant. Well, any of those processes would work. Mahatma Gandhi said when he was troubled, he would open the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, Rasaraj Prabhu. Oh no, behind Rasaraj. Yes.
Do you think the search for perfection can be a selfish desire? I mean, some people want to become God.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on your definition of perfection. But the highest perfection is devotional service to Krishna, and that it's somewhat of a paradox, but it's selfless, but you get more through selfless service than you could get any other way. It's there's a nice verse that says bhukti mukti siddhi Krishna bhakta shanta. Krishna bhakta nishkam ata eva shanta. It says that the karmis who want material enjoyment, bhukti, the yogis who want mystic perfections, siddhi, and the gyanis who want impersonal liberation, mukti, none of them is peaceful. Bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakala ashanta. Krishna bhakta nishkam ata eva shanta. Only a devotee, pure devotee, is free from desires, and therefore only he is peaceful. And as the Bhagavad Gita says, without peace, where is the question of happiness? Nate vidu swartha gatim hi Vishnu. Srila Prabhupada said that it's natural to be interested in your self-interest. Everyone is concerned about his self-interest. But you have to know what your real self is. And when you know that your real self is the eternal servant of Krishna, then you know that your real self-interest is to serve Krishna. And by that you realize your own best interest and the best interest of all living entities and the whole creation. So, yeah, it fulfills your heart's deepest desires, but in the process you give up selfish desires. But then you realize what your real self is, and then you're fully satisfied and happy. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premanandi Hare Gaur.
Jai.